Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Bethany Gilbert and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune and Pastor Dusty White of Coram Deo Church. On Wednesdays, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life, and today we're talking about secular praise music.
Chris Hemelman sent us an article and then
didn't show up.
Didn't show
up
for the podcast.
What a leader.
So this is an interesting topic we're going to get to in a moment. But first, I want to give some gratitude for the amazing array of snacks that were provided for today's podcast by listener Steve, whose daughter, Sarah, is the kitchen manager for Myrtle and Cypress Coffee House. Dusty, down in our old neighborhood, down by the Bird Street Chapel.
That's right, downtown by the airport. Hey, this cinnamon roll is bomb.
It's amazing. I'm going to read you listeners a list of everything that was provided by Steve. It's sort of like they're just doing like a Myrtle and Cypress advertisement on the Wednesday Conversation. And they figured out that the way to get us to do an ad read is just bring so many snacks that we can't avoid acknowledging your excellence. And so Myrtle and Cypress is a local coffee shop. The one is on 33rd and Cass Street. That's the original one. And they also have one inside the Omaha Conservatory of Music at 72nd and Cass. So two locations. Here is what they brought for this podcast, Dusty. Are you ready?
Man.
Two gluten-free cinnamon rolls, one butternut squash savory hand pie, one apple hand pie, one savory scone, one blueberry almond scone, one grain-free brownie, one carrot cake muffin, one oatmeal date cookie, one chocolate chip cookie, one pecan pie bar. All gluten-free.
Yeah. I mean, basically you can have like three or four because they're gluten-free.
They taste delicious. Everything's delicious.
I do want to acknowledge that I hate the taste of gluten-free things generally, but these are all very good. Like I was like, wow, this is impressive. And my wife is gluten-free. And so when we go places, it's like, usually it's like, here's your one gluten-free option. It's like this really crummy muffin
here's
over
your cardboard.
Here. Right. So I want to honor the fact that, man, Myrtle and Cypress seems to have figured out the gluten-free baking component. And they also brought us, by the way, two bags of coffee beans and then one container of iced coffee. That's a delicious Honduras
man
roast. Blessings. So basically the whole Coramdale Church building is eating pastries and drinking coffee right now, courtesy of Steve and the good folks at Myrtle and Cypress Coffee House. So thanks, Myrtle and Cypress. We wish you excellence in your business and we hope all listeners go to your coffee shop tomorrow and spend a lot of money buying your products. That's as close as you're going to get to an advertisement on this podcast.
Sponsored by.
We're not sponsored, but hey, you know what? You bring us a lot of snacks. We'll give you a shout out.
Yeah, for sure.
Who can we get next?
Who wants this much airplay on the Wednesday Conversation? Hey, you didn't mention we do have a special guest.
We do have a special guest.
To be introduced later.
Yes.
Listeners, you're going to have to wait to hear who our special guest is. A person who has some expertise in this area that we're going to talk about at some level, or at least has a hot take or an opinion on it. So Chris Hellman sent us this article. It's from Yahoo, which I was like, Chris, I don't usually read things from Yahoo. It's not quite the same as like the New York Times.
I feel like it's not the first article Chris has sent us from Yahoo either.
I feel
either.
Like Chris might have the Yahoo news feed on his phone.
He might.
But I read the article and I was like, actually, this is really intriguing. The article title is "Everyone is listening to secular praise music. Yes, even you." And the author, the subtitle of the article is "Artists like Benson Boone, Teddy Swims, and Alex Warren have tapped into a genre of music that sounds religious but isn't. It's working." It's kind of a long form article and I'm going to summarize three different sections of the article. So I think there's three sort of movements here that are interesting to me. I couldn't tell whether I agree with the point this author is making or whether I'm like, this is an author who's just trying to sort of like talk about something in a culture in a way that a lot of people would read it. You know, clickbait is a thing and authors are good at pitching ideas in a way that is going to capture people's attention. So that's part of why I have our special guest on today's podcast is to give us an opinion on that fact. But let me read to you a few excerpts from this long form article from Yahoo. The article starts by acknowledging two very popular songs right now. One is Ordinary by Alex Warren, which has now spent 7 weeks at number one on the Billboard Hot 100. It's just a love song, says the article, but Warren sings about the angels up in the clouds, the hopeless hallelujah on this side of heaven's gate, and at your altar I will pray, you're the sculptor, I'm the clay.
Wow.
Sounds kind of like a biblical reference. Feels like Corinthians. It sounds religious, says the author, but ordinary is part of a growing genre of secular praise music. The article's point is like, actually, that's not a biblical reference. He's just using biblical images and metaphors to sing a love song. The second song that the author references in the article is Teddy Swims' Lose Control, which I hear this song all the time, everywhere in the world. The article says, Teddy Swims' Lose Control has been on the Billboard charts for a whopping 100 weeks. It is the first song to crack that milestone. It came out in 2023 when Taylor Swift's Cruel Summer was ruling the airwaves, and it's still unavoidable. It's been on the charts for 2 whole years.
So is she. She's unavoidable.
Yeah, well, but that's because she's coming out with another album. Meanwhile, this song is just still getting played from 2 years ago. And the author of this article says, Teddy Swims admonishes himself for acting like an addict and giving into bad habits, admitting his flaws and begging for forgiveness, two common elements in worship songs sung in that context to God, meaning obviously in worship, you're singing those things to God. In Teddy Swims' song, he's singing them to a woman. And the point the author makes is that the religious elements of these two songs make them sound vaguely like they could be played in church. And to that point, she is suggesting that we should refer to this as secular praise music, or that there's something intentional these artists are doing to tap into the same kinds of things you would experience in worship music. So the author starts with these two very popular songs and says, hey, these songs have some similar, have some biblical themes and ideas in them. They're sort of aping the idea of worship. And that's the first thing is, okay, so there's these two popular songs. The author wants you to see, hey, this is a movement, this is a thing, and she's calling it secular praise music. Now, at this point, I'm going to bring in our special guest.
Whoa.
Locally famous musical artist, Kyle Christensen, also communications coordinator here at Coramdale Church. Kyle, welcome to the podcast.
Happy to be here.
Kyle is actually a real and talented musician and a guy who's been playing music locally and recording music locally, both with a worship focus and also just out there in the world playing non-worship music for a long time. You've been doing this a long time. I'm curious what you think, Kyle, of like, all right, so I don't know if you've listened to these two particular songs, but is it true that there are some artists right now that seem to be sort of connecting? I guess what I'm saying is this a new thing, or haven't artists always done this? Like, as I read this, I was like, well, U2 did this and Mumford and Sons did that. I mean, this isn't really a new thing. I feel like there's always been artists that have sort of leaned on biblical metaphor and allusion. So what's your read as you sort of read this piece and think about what's happening in music more broadly?
Well, I'd heard one of the songs, but I went and listened to all the other ones.
That away. What a good today. What a good podcast prep.
I did not research.
I did not.
I think it's true that bands have done it before, or like use like church or biblical imagery and not been Christian bands to a certain extent. But I feel like this is like really pivoting from what has been popular in pop music previously to like now these pop songs are borrowing production tricks from Christian music, Christian artists, like worship music, in order to kind of elicit the same response. So like, I think that these worship music produced and recorded worship music for a long time has like built out these sort of like standards that they do, you know, lots of like choiry vocals and like big emotional instrumentation and melodies to try to kind of elicit that worshipful response. And I feel like that's kind of what these artists are doing. They're grabbing those tricks and doing that to try to elicit the same sort of feelings. And yeah.
That's fascinating because that's what the author of this article points out when she has a section. So how do you know if a song is secular praise music? And I was like, that's my question. What counts as quote unquote secular praise music? And the first thing she points out is production, which is what you said. It's like this chorusy vocals. You just said it. Chorusy vocals, sort of like a big build that sort of, you know, generates emotional energy. And you're saying that like, yeah, these, you do see that these artists are sort of, that began in Christian worship music and now it's sort of being used more broadly. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah. And I think it's, I don't want to speak negatively of it. It's an effective means to do that. But I think the way it's being used here feels more of like more cheap and more of like a ploy to elicit a response in lieu of being more genuinely artistic or honest. It's more of like a, you know, we're just going to try to make you feel a certain way based on like these three things we're going to do with this song.
Kyle, I'm grateful that you're here. I admire you greatly and your own musicianship. And I have a question for you. This is straight ignorance, okay? Do you think these lyrics that are coming together by like Benson Boone, et cetera, are on purpose? And are they writing them? Do you think Benson Boone is scribbling this stuff down in the airplane? Or do you think he's being handed these lyrics?
You know, hard to tell sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, I do
think. You think there's someone generating all these songs, maybe, Dusty, and then saying, Kyle, sing this. Maybe. Dusty, sing this.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, I do think there's co-writers, and to what degree they're co-writing, we may never know. But like, I wouldn't doubt that they're contributing like decently to the songs, just based on the fact that these are like artists who are like making their name on like who they are and like their kind of their story. So
yeah,
I would assume they're contributing meaningfully.
Kyle, I think what's interesting about what you said a minute ago is you said that they're trying to tap into this emotive register, right? And create a certain feeling for people. And you said that can be kind of cynical, right? It's a production trick that we know this will work. This will make people feel a certain way. But one of the things the author points out is that because we live in a social media world, everybody's looking for a soundtrack for their epic life moment, their engagement or their death of a pet or their, you know, it's like they're going to post something on social media and I need a cool soundtrack under it. And so there actually is sort of this demand, if you want to call it that, for like emotive music that elicits a response. And the author notices that that's kind of what these production values are tapping into is, hey, let me give you a cool anthemic big soundtrack for this big life moment that you're going to post on TikTok or whatever.
Yeah. I think it's hard not to be cynical about the music when you start to think about the amount of people touching it and like what it needs to do for like everybody involved in it to be successful. You start to get a little cynical about the process and the song itself.
Yeah. And rightly so, I would imagine.
Do you think this is just like coincidental and there's this, we shouldn't be too worried about it, and this is just a new thing because it was just Coldplay and U2 back in the day and we were just like, oh, we'll give them a nod. But do you think this is like some sort of random revival happening in big production?
I tend to think, first of all, Coldplay, U2, like bands like that, Mumford and Sons.
They were actually good.
I know. Well, yeah. I feel like.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's my hot take.
Here's what I feel like part of what is happening is like you have, this is going to sound really mean, but you have actual artists creating art that is very unique. And then downstream, you have derivative of that. Like people are now borrowing from these things because they've seen them be successful and they're taking bits and pieces from that and employing it in a way to try to elicit the same sorts of responses.
Sure.
I also think though, maybe you guys experience this differently. I feel like there's a cultural shift away from like ironic detachment to like real, like sincerity and like openness and like radical honesty. Saying with air quotes, like that is kind of part and parcel of this shift in like how pop music, certain types of pop.
No, I think you're right. There's definitely a shift toward authenticity, honesty, vulnerability. Those things are more powerful now than they were 5 or 10 years ago. And it is interesting that music sort of follows that. And I think you're right. I mean, even your joke, Bethany, like, yeah, I think U2 is an amazingly creative band. And I know people are all free to have their own musical taste, but I think, yeah, U2, what's interesting is U2 and Coldplay and even Mumford & Sons did all this when you still had to buy records or go to a show.
Yeah.
And the advent of streaming seems like it's part of the dynamic here of like, with streaming music, it's so much harder to make yourself stand out, find an audience. You can get any music anywhere in the world on your phone at any moment. And so I imagine that for an artist, they're trying to, if they want to be commercially successful and not just artistically successful, they're probably trying to answer the question, how do I get most ears on this song? And that I don't know, Kyle, you're the musician, not me, but I imagine that at a certain popular level, at a certain commercial level, that does get a little bit formulaic of like, well, we know this will work. We know we can get ears with this kind of production or with this kind of hook, right?
I think that works for real worship music because it's written with the intention of like the church singing it. So it is accessible. It is, you know, it is a little paint by numbers sometimes, but like that's with the intention that we're trying to be inclusive in what we're singing and how we're singing it. And maybe that's kind of where this is seeming like it's a little bit less than what we would want from popular music.
Yeah. I was curious here in the article, the author says, secular praise songs like these include poetic verses that build to a striking emotional chorus. The lyrics appeal to members of the community or to someone powerful. And when they mention God, it's usually as part of a familiar phrase rather than an actual appeal to a spiritual being. Elements of stomping and clapping, or even the addition of a background choir, add to the praise song vibe. One music producer who was interviewed for this article says that streaming has shaped this format because now songs must grab the listener's attention quickly and deliver a strong emotional payoff to keep them engaged, which is just interesting to me because it reminds me of a story years ago when we released, it was either the Psalms album or the Swallowed Up Death album. We took it to a local Christian radio station that was still locally owned because we were like, well, let's just see if we can get this some airplay. So we, you know, took a song and said, hey, we got to listen to this. And I knew the station manager. So, you know, as a person, I felt like, oh, we got a personal connection here. There's at least some chance, you know? And so he took the CD or whatever we gave him. And I don't know if it was a CD or what it was.
Probably.
It wasn't stream. It wasn't like just here, listen to this MP3.
It's side B.
And his feedback was, yeah, the song doesn't, he basically said that to get airplay, you have to do something impressive for the listener within the first 15 seconds. And if you don't, then we just won't play it. And it was really interesting to me that it was that formulaic. I was like, really? So you're telling me that like, this is a really cool song, but because it doesn't do the thing you want within the first 15 seconds, it's just not even like, you're not interested in it.
Yeah. We don't have the patience for that anymore.
But it is interesting to me that there's obviously a commercial formula there being applied.
Yeah. I think when you get to that level, it's a business more than it is art.
Yeah.
And there's artistic qualities to it, but like hard to judge it by the same standards.
Yeah.
And Spotify has changed the game here.
Yeah.
Right. So everybody has it. And that obviously changes the industry. And those first 15 seconds matter probably more than they ever have. Because there's songs in the 80s and 90s that you're just completely patient with.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because they just keep looping and playing. And that was part of the beauty of it.
Yeah. I want to. Obviously, this isn't a music podcast. I want to get to sort of what the reason I'm interested in this is because of the connection this has for Christians to just a thing that's happening in the culture that I think is interesting. And part of it is what you said, Kyle, of there's a move toward authenticity and away from cynicism. And you're seeing that reflected in all kinds of art, both music and streaming shows and movies. And so I think that's something Christians need to be aware of, is that actually people are finding it interesting right now to be authentic and honest. And that's, I think, good news for those of us who love Christ and want to connect the gospel to our neighbors and friends. But I also, part of what I want to think about on this podcast is just what's happening in the culture that clues us into what people are longing for or hungry for, or where the questions they're asking might have resonance with the gospel. And one thing that was interesting to me in this article is that the author points out that what these lyrics are doing is they're tapping into some kind of longing for transcendence. And even what the production value is doing, what you mentioned, Kyle, is like if an anthemic build in a song is kind of, there's an emotive power to it and it's pulling me into a moment, obviously we see how, well, yeah, because in Christian worship, we're trying to sort of pull our souls into this sense of worshiping and adoring God. But even in any human being who's not a Christian, there's still a longing for meaning and transcendence and to be caught up in something. And that's kind of what these songs are creating, is this opportunity to be caught up in something that feels big. It feels like there's something beyond me that's interesting and compelling. And that, to me, is an interesting feature of something that's happening in the culture right now that connects to a very significant biblical theme.
Yeah, I think there's a longing for genuine community, too, which is part of the appeal. Like, I think people are feeling lonely and they want that appeal of, like, you know, there's a song with a choir in it. We're all singing it together. Like, we're all, and I think that's part of like how some of these like hits are designed, is like, we're envisioning a bunch of people singing these together. So I'm going to make them so they are singable together. And I also think too, the lyrical content, or like the themes of these, are a lot about like, you know, I'm not perfect, I've done bad things, but like, I'm looking for redemption, I'm looking for hope. Like, there's like a redemptive narrative, I think, to a lot of these songs that is appealing for people too, like both the community and redemption, like kind of together, I believe.
That's really fascinating. The other thing that connects to that, it's not just the listeners who are looking for community, but at a commercial level, the author points out that the labels are looking for community, because, you know, the labels that used to be able to make money off selling a bunch of albums, now the only way they can make money is if they can connect you to enough people who want to share an experience that they can sponsor a concert, or they can get a bunch of people listening together. And so it's interesting, like, we all want community, but also community is powerful, not just at a personal relational level, but like, it's actually one of the things that drives our economy, is people want to know, like, what can I do with other people? And it used to be, we listen to music together. And now everybody streams music on their own device while they're working out at the gym, Dusty. And so the labels are looking for what do we have that can create a sense of like, people might want to come together and sing this song together in a big room.
We're going to Matt Carney this week.
We? Who's we?
And Kyle? My family.
Oh, you and
me.
Okay.
And
you looked at Kyle when you said kids.
I'm not invited.
And I was wondering, he jokes in his promo of that show, he likes coming to Nebraska because we're the only people who can say his last name because of Carney, Nebraska. So that's a hat tip to us. But it's interesting to think about that community aspect with like algorithms and data points. I wonder if they can, if an artist or a producer can actually look at Nebraska, Iowa, and say, well, we got a lot of listeners there. Let's go do a show. Is that a thing?
I'm sure that's a thing. I also think that's probably why you see like these, you're seeing more and more of the artists themselves is like, we're going to like, it's not really just about your music. It's about everything about who you are. The more we can make you known to the fans, like the more they can feel like they know you and participate. And instead of just being like an artist making music, no, you're like a figurehead, a symbol of like bigger things beyond just your music.
The last two paragraphs of this article read like this: releasing songs with vague religious elements, as well as memorable anthemic choruses and family-friendly lyrics, can unite listeners across the country despite how we're fractured in other ways by algorithms and political tension. Musical tastes are cyclical, and this format is resonating right now because people are craving emotional release, Roberts says. This is one of the producers who's interviewed in the article. We're living in a time where everything feels loud, digitally, socially, politically. These songs slow things down, pull you in gently, and give you that euphoric burst in the chorus, it's a structure that mimics the arc of a personal breakthrough. That's where the article ends. And it's interesting, they use the language of personal breakthrough, use the language of a redemptive narrative, but it's kind of the getting at the same thing, right? That idea of like, man, maybe my life can have a breakthrough. Maybe there's like something coming for me that redeems my story or that makes life meaningful. That's part of the emotive power of some of these songs. And it is interesting that this producer is acknowledging, yeah, and that's kind of what people are needing in a moment where everything feels really fragmented and fractured and disorienting.
This is so interesting because I kind of, for the longest time, used to be anti-Christian music because I felt like secular singers usually tapped into some of the actual like emotions that I felt or like would voice things that I thought were more honest than actual like Christian music. And so it's just, and I'm also just holding like the whole, you know, Hillsong kind of worship style that I feel like was always such a, like, it was such a miss for me. Cause I'm just like, this is, you're trying to be like these big rock stars, like these secular singers. And now it's like, they're borrowing, like the tables have turned, they're borrowing from each other. And so it's just, it's interesting to see how this is playing out and why it's happening that way. And I think the other thing that is really fascinating is kind of what you said, Bob, about people using, like, creating these songs and them being used to tell like stories on their social media or to like pull people in and create these like emotional like moments. It's just, I see that everywhere. And it's fascinating.
In youth group, they have the posters on the wall of, if you like a certain secular artist, you should listen to this Christian artist that sounds like them. Exactly. And now it's like, you'd have to have the opposite chart now.
Well, it's interesting to me because I was thinking about that. I feel like the ways that Christians and even writers like this always want to have the conversation is who's borrowing from who? Is it Christian music that's borrowing from pop music or is it the other way around? And this is interesting because this author is saying it's kind of the other way around right now. But the more interesting thing to me that I think both of those framings miss is the fact of the human desire for transcendence, for redemption, for emotionally powerful experiences. That's the thing that's interesting to me. And what it makes me think of is that in Mike Cosper's book, Rhythms of Grace, you know, which is a few years old now, but it was one we that helped us think a lot about worship. One of Cosper's points that he makes in that book is what he calls the Coldplay effect. And he was working in a context where people were skeptical of like, worship that felt like it was more like a
emotionally, you know, like a, manipulative,
or even just worship that felt like it wasn't hymns, but it was more like fresh songs that they were writing. Mm-hmm. And he said one of the knocks on that was, well, you know, we can't all sing those songs together. The nice thing about a hymn is everybody can sing it together and you can do harmonies and stuff. But these newer worship songs, we can't do that. And his pushback was, have you ever gone to a Coldplay concert? Hmm. Obviously not, because like if you go to a Coldplay concert, everybody in the room is singing the song together. And his point was, I think, just that there is something in human beings that longs to sort of participate together in singing, which is what the church has always done. It's like the unique thing that it always meant to be part of a church is this is a place where we all sing together. And it is interesting that that taps into, even as our culture sort of gets de-Christianized, that longing to sing together, to have powerful experiences together, to appreciate big moments together is still present. And that seems to be what some of these pop songs are sort of tapping into, is there's just a latent human desire. You can tap into it as a worship songwriter, or you can tap into it as a pop songwriter, but either way, you're sort of tapping the same thing in a human being that longs for that sense of connectedness.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about. I do think the community piece in this article is the most compelling to me that I'm still just kind of thinking about. And it also speaks to just the loneliness that is there. Like if you can have these types of lyrics, you know, whichever artist you are, if you can pull in these type of lonely people or these type of depressed people or these type of addicts or, you know, whatever it is, and then I can lace that with a little bit of hope, to your point, Kyle, that's a redemptive type of theme. And so obviously the answer is you need to find community in the local church and worship there. Am I right?
Come Amen. Sing with us on a Sunday. It's fun.
Yeah, that's right. And Kyle might be up there leading, yeah. helping to lead us. Kyle, you said you listened to some of the songs in this article in preparation for the podcast. Was there any of them you actually liked, or is it just like, yeah, I had to listen to these to sort of be intelligent for the podcast?
Probably a bad person to ask. not my cup of tea.
That's great.
I would like to make an appeal, though. I don't think that you, from an artistic perspective, I don't think you have to sacrifice artistry to get these other desirable qualities that we're talking about yeah. in worship music or otherwise. Like, I think there can be transcendence and we can experience powerful emotions, not just through adding a choir to the song and doing all those kinds of things. Those are effective, but I think that we can, that effective, well-written songs don't have to be just four chords and that we can all access. It can be, you know, more artistic than that. Although there are a lot of songs that have, you know, very simple that are also have artistic merit too.
I'm glad you said that, because that's one of the things that you do well and that I think a lot of our songwriters at Coram Deo have done well, is just trying to do things that are creative and interesting but not inaccessible. Where it's like, okay, we're not going to be, we want as artists to do things that are interesting and unique and that contribute something beautiful and meaningful, but also that someone could sing along to. And that's been really beautiful for you to help lead in that.
Yeah, I appreciate, Kyle, what you're saying there. I hear you saying we can be honest, transcendent, redemptive, and still play with excellence, right? As the scriptures would call us to. And all, we don't have to sell out to wherever culture is at right now when it comes to musicianship.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, thank you for listening in. We pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. We'd love to hear from listeners, so if you have thoughts, questions, or future podcast topics, send an email to podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.